But I officially would begin at 8:20, so I want to get started. And I'd like to welcome everyone to the Rabbinic Outreach Training Course class. Great to have a number of guys back from last year and new guys that are joining us. And we look forward to a wonderful year learning together. Just technically, I just want to begin with the following, and then I'll introduce Rabbi Berzon. If everyone could just fill out their name, phone number, email, and also one other issue is just the in terms of the shimush position. So if you can pass this around. If you can just write down what you're interested in doing, or if you have something lined up. I know I met with a couple, or most of the guys here. I think there are a couple of guys here that I didn't have a chance to meet with, so we can. We can take the opportunity to do that at some point soon. But if you could fill that out, and you can, we can hand that in towards the end of the session. So tonight is the opening session, and it's a great honor and a pleasure to have Rabbi Azariah Berzon with us. Rabbi Berzon is a well-known Rav here in Yerushalayim. He has taught for many years in a number of institutions, started a number of yeshivot here in Israel. What were the names of those?
We started in Male Adumim, Birchat Moshe. It's a Hesed yeshiva.
Yes.
Shalvin for a decade. And then we had Mevaser Tzion. I don't know if anyone knows the yeshiva there. Shari Mevaser Tzion. That was for about 20 years.
And Rabbi Berzon is now the Rav of the Emek Learning Center and Rosh Kollel there as well. And there are a couple of guys from Gris guys that are now learning at that kollel. And Rabbi Berzon also has a few thousand shiurim on YU Torah. I think, is it 6,000 now? Yeah. Over 6,000 shiurim on YU Torah. So you could take a look at that.
But they didn't give me a password until recently.
And so it's really a great book. And I daven, and I'm a Talmud and the congregant of Rabbi Berzon in Katamon at the Emek Learning Center, so it's a great pleasure to be able to have Rabbi Berzon with us tonight. And the topic is, I think, a very appropriate topic to begin our discussion for over the next number of months together, and that is leadership, the rabbinate in America, and I would say leadership in general, but we'll hear from Rabbi Berzon. And all of us, no matter what we are intending to do in terms of becoming synagogue, pulpit rabbis, or mechanchim, or leaders in the community, all of us as rabbis are going to be leaders and people that others are going to look up to and turn to for advice, for guidance, and as rabbinic personalities. So I thank Rabbi Berzon for being with us, Yashar Koach, and look forward to hearing your talk.
Thank you. Shalom Aleichem, everyone. I think I was in Gris before you were born. It's really dating myself. And anyone who wants to come by to see our kollel, because I know that Gris usually gives you, what, 2 or 3 years, and then you're on your own, as things change since my day. So if anyone wants to stay in Eretz Yisrael, anyway, Bechlal, just to see what's going on in the Emek Learning Center, please let me know, and we'll try to host you for a Shabbos with your families. By way of introduction, I want to tell you a little about myself. You know, they talk about the concept of shimush, and I was zocha baruch Hashem to have shimush with my father, Zichron Levracha, and help him as an aide, as an assistant for many, many years in his rabbonus. He was a rav in Flatbush, in Brooklyn. Before that, he started his career after he got smicha from Yeshiva University. At that time, it wasn't called Yeshiva University, it was called Yeshiva College. And it only gained university status later on. So the head of Yeshiva College at that time was Dr. Bernard Revel. I'm sure you've heard of him. And my father had a very close relationship with Dr. Revel. My father came from Europe at a young age of 12. His family settled in Akron, Ohio. And they wanted to ship him off to Akron, Ohio, where his grandparents were. But he said, absolutely not. He knew there was no yeshiva in Akron. And at the age of 12, at that ripe old age, he made a decision that he wanted to stay in New York. And they sent him to Rav Yitzchak Chanan Yeshiva. And as a European who didn't know a word of English at that age, they sent him to public school to learn English while he was learning in yeshiva the rest of the day. And he literally sat with children who were 4 and 5 years old in a class and wanted to learn English. And as he grew in learning, he became more and more interested in the Rabbanus. And that's what he did. He went into Rabbanus at the age of 22. That's when he got smicha. I'll just tell you a little about the smicha requirements in those days. I'm sure you're aware of this, but just as a chazara, you had to be tested by 3 rabbanim, one of whom was my father's Rebbe, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and they could ask you any questions whatsoever. Now, my recommendation, if you ever have a choice, which I had in my master's program, between an exam that's oral or exam that's written, don't go for the oral exam, because they just shoot questions at you, and if you hesitate with the answers, they fail you. So you can imagine what Rabbanus was like to get smicha from the yeshiva, 3 rabbanim who could ask you anywhere. Of course, they asked you in your Yoredeya, which meant they asked you questions in Issur V'Heter, Chelek Aleph, and also in Hilchos Nida, plus mikvos, and these were questions that were shot at you. But then the exam started. After you proved what you knew in your Yoredeya, then they asked you questions from all over Shas. So I remember my father telling me that one of the questions they asked him was, Yalkagam, you know, what does Yalkagam stand for? And if you hesitated, it didn't look good for you. But for my father, at the time of the Depression, he had just gotten married to my mother, he was less than 22 years old, smicha meant a future for him. Because if he didn't have ordination, he couldn't get a job as a rabbi. So this was a very important exam. In many cases, the tribunal of 3 rabbanim would send you back to the Beis Medrash for another half a year before you could even take a retest. And Baruch Hashem, my father was able to pass. I'll tell you one cute story, just for your own interest. The exam in mikvos at that time was given by a rav by the name of Rav Aronovich. He was a Telzer who came from Telz Yeshiva, and he did not sign on that my father had been tested in mikvos. In the meantime, at the ripe old age of 22, shortly after he got his smicha, he got offered a position in Bangor, Maine. And he didn't get his smicha because in yeshiva he kept calling for his smicha, send me the klaf, and they kept saying, well, Rav Aronovich did not officially test you in mikvos. So this dragged on for months, and my father said, I have to do something about it. So he took a long bus trip from Bangor, Maine to New York, and he made a meeting with Rav Aronovich, and it was on Chol HaMoed Sukkos. So what they started doing was sitting together. Rav Aronovich was firing question after question on mikvos. After about an hour, my father said, Rebbe, heint is yontif, without drinking epis. It's yontif today, we have to drink something. Oh, so the Rashiva comes, he takes out some good schnapps, and they have a l'chaim. Then he tests him for another half hour. And after a half hour, my father says, Rebbe, heint is yontif, without tansin in this. So they get up, imagine this, tells it with my father, and they start dancing. And they had another couple of schnappses, and then my father noticed that Rav Aronovich was red in the face. So he decided to ask the Roshiva to lay down on the couch. He covered him with a blanket. And then he went back to Bangor, Maine. Another month went by and he still didn't get his klaf. So he called up. They said, you have to work this out with Rav Aronovich. So he calls up his Rebbe. And he's, Rebbe, what's going on? He says, I remember that we spoke in learning, but I don't remember the end of it. What happened at the end? So my father started reminding him of all the shilas that he was asking and all the answers that he gave him. He said, okay, you know. And he sent the signature. My father got the klaf. And he was a rav in Bangor, Maine. I want to share with you the following idea that I think is so important in leadership. And that is, you never know what kind of question you're going to be asked. So what was my father's first shila as a rav in Bangor, Maine? His very, very first shila. There was an elderly couple that had saved and put away every single penny of their savings for 55 years in order to eventually go on a cruise around the world. Everything was set. They bought the tickets for the cruise. I'll say this in Yiddish and then I'll translate it for anyone who doesn't know Yiddish. When Erez gestorben, he died. So she comes over to my father and she says, Rebbe, can I start Shiva here in Bangor and then complete my Shiva on the cruise? Because imagine that they had saved all of their savings for this cruise. I mean, she had the ticket. What she was going to do? She had to go on the cruise. And it reminds me, you know, there's a famous story about two golfers. You know, they settled in an area where they had access to a golf course. And every Monday morning, you know, clockwork, they would play golf together on this beautiful tee, you know, the green grass. And then one day they were shooting golf and they noticed that there was a funeral going on in the distance. So one of the two golfers gets up, he stands with great respect until he sees that the funeral procession passes by. So his friend the golfer says to him, that was very nice. I really respect the fact that you did such a thing. He says, I think she deserved that. We were married together for 35 years. You know, you can't give up golf for anything. So you can't give a cruise around the world for anything, no matter what. So the Shiloh was, can you sit Shiva, you know, start here and then end on the cruise? And that was my father's first Shiloh. Somebody asked my father when he was in Bangor, Maine, whether he was Yotze Kaddish. He pointed to somebody, he says, so what was the problem with that person's Kaddish? He used to say, Scotch, Scotch, Yehei Rabbah. That to him was Kaddish. Again, I don't know if you can appreciate the level of ignorance in Bangor, Maine. Bangor, Maine at that time was a very important shtut because a lot of shchita was done in Bangor, Maine. And I'll talk about that a little bit later on because I think that's also a very important point. With regard to shilas in general, I think it's very important to know who to ask and how to ask the question. And once again, I want to demonstrate this with a story. After the Yom Kippur War in 1973, there was a great request, a bikush, for Sifrei Torah in Eretz Yisrael. There was quite a hisorus, and they didn't have enough Sifrei Torah. And in my father's shul in Flatbush, there were many, many Sifrei Torah that were pretty much out of use. They had been donated by people back in the end of the 1800s. And my father decided that we should ship off a bunch of Sifrei Torah to Eretz Yisrael. But he had a shiloh. He wasn't sure if you didn't have to have permission from those who donated the Sefer Torah to give away the Sefer Torah, because they still have bialus, they have ownership over the Sefer. I was learning at that time in the Rav Shir up in the Heights, and my father was in Brooklyn, and he said, Azariah, do me a favor. You see the Rav 3 times a week, chap him and ask him this question. I really want to send the Sifrei Torah to Israel urgently. So I caught the Rav after Shia, and I said to him, Rebbe, I have a shiloh. He says, where's your father? He says, my father delegated this agency to me to ask the shiloh. So the Rav listens to the shiloh, and immediately he starts quoting the Minchas Chinuch in the last mitzvah of Taryag, which is the mitzvah of Ksiva Sefer Torah. And the Minchas Chinuch vacillates back and forth. How do you fulfill this mitzvah? Is it enough that you have the Sefer Torah written? In other words, you commission the writing of the Sefer Torah, or no, you have to own the Sefer Torah. And the bialus of the Sefer Torah is a precondition in fulfilling this mitzvah, which means that according to that side, the Minchas Chinuch and Rav Soloveitchik accepted that approach. When you donate a Sefer Torah to a shul, you don't give it as an outright gift. It's on loan. It's like if you've ever seen a museum, if you look carefully in the print, they tell you who owns the painting. It's only on loan. So in order to maintain ownership over the Sefer Torah, not forfeit the mitzvah of Ksiva Sefer Torah, according to this tzad, you have to maintain ownership. So the Rav says to me, tell your father that you should get permission from those who donated the Sefer Torah. I come back to Brooklyn. I tell my father the psak. He doesn't like it. He says, wait a minute. With all due respect, Azariah, I'm going up to the Heights. You know, in those days, you took the A train. It was slow as molasses. Anyway, so my father came up to the Heights, and he sits down with Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he explains to him, Rebbe, I have to tell you the following. Those people who donated the Sefer Torah, not only are they long gone, I don't know if there's any way of tracking down their yarshim, their heirs, their grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren. And not only that, even if they're still alive, I doubt if they have any shaykes to Yiddishkeit whatsoever. So the Rav says, send the Sifrei Torah to Eretz Yisrael. And within a week's time, my father sent off 12 Sifrei Torah to Eretz Yisrael. So you have to see how to ask the question, to whom to ask the question. You know, you ask a Rav who thinks in Lomdish terms, in conceptual terms, you'll get one answer. But then when you get down to the practical elements and you describe the reality, if you formulate your question properly, and especially when there's an urgent need to send the Sifrei Torah, you might get a different answer. I want to ask the following question. Are there situations in which you can paskin for yourself? You're a rav of a shul, and it's very important to keep in touch with poskim. Again, if they were going to ask you about a pot in the pan, whether the milchiks became fleishiks, whether the parva became milchiks, you know enough in your idea, you can paskin. They ask you a shayla or a chayim, a question about the kaddish or avelus or yizkar or something of that sort. No hesitation, you don't have to be inhibited. But what happens when a serious issue comes up for the fore? And here, it's critical to keep a connection with poskim. On rare occasions, though, when I think you could say the following, this is my own formulation, if Klal Yisrael is involved, this is an issue that could have a ripple effect, a repercussion for the Klal, then you may have to make the decision yourself. And if you do so, you have to realize you're taking a risk. You may succeed, and you may be victorious, but the opposite could happen as well. In my father's career, I want to share with you two stories. One which was quite successful, the other which was not, and my father took a stand on his own. As I mentioned to you before, Bangor, Maine was one of the centers in the United States back in the 1930s for Shechita. So my father was a Rav in Bangor, Maine in 1935 till 37. And here's what happened. I don't know if you know this phrase. How many people would know? Again, I'm using a lot of Yiddish tonight. I hope you don't mind. The Treifa Medina. Have you ever heard that phrase? You know, when people sent off their children to America from Europe in those days, they thought that's it. You know, America's the Treifa Medina. Well, here's a story that'll prove to you that America is the Treifa Medina. Because my father discovered that the shoftim, two shoftim, major shoftim in Bangor, Maine, were feeding Klal Yisrael nevelus and treifas. He tested them in shechita. They didn't know a thing. They were just charlatans. They were fakers. But they had been involved in shechita for quite a number of years. I won't tell you how long. So my father fought against them. And guess what? He lost the battle. They were too powerful. They were too connected in the city of Bangor that on Yom Kippur, Leil Yom Kippur, after the second year of my father's, you know, Rabbonis in Bangor, he got up at Kol Nidre and he says, either they leave Bangor or I leave Bangor. And my father had to leave Bangor. So there was a case where he took a stand. There was a chief rabbi of the state of Maine. He wasn't officially the chief rabbi. He was in a different city in Maine. I forgot the name of it right now. Anyway, he wrote a letter to my father. I still have the letter, in which he castigates my father for doing such a thing. Imagine, my father was just trying to get kosher meat on the market. But this rabbi in another major city said that he did a terrible thing by fighting against these shochtim. And at the end, he had to leave Bangor, Maine. So my father leaves Bangor, Maine, and he gets offered a couple of different shtelas. Most of them are very small communities that have very little of a future. But then he gets an offer in Flatbush. Now again, I have to describe to you Flatbush in those days. We're talking the 1930s. This is not Flatbush today, which is an extension of Borough Park. This is Flatbush in the day when you could count the frum people who are Shomer Shabbos on one hand and you'd still have a few fingers to spare. And my father took over this Rabbanus. I heard now that the previous Rav's grandson is teaching Torah in the old city. So I'm very excited to meet him and tell him a few stories that my father shared with me about his grandfather, who was the previous Rav in Flatbush, in that shul. So my father takes over the Rabbonus. The stipend, the salary, it was the condition was that 3 out of 4 Shabbosim he would darshan in Yiddish and 1 out of 4 for the young American people in English. Then it changed, it was 2 and 2 and then it became 3 and 1 until when I was being brought up. The only time my father gave a drush in Yiddish was Shabbos HaGadol and Shabbos Shuvah and Aser Yisrael Shuvah. So in order to make ends meet, because my Baruch Hashem, my father and my mother had already a few children, my father took on a job as the chaplain in the Coney Island Hospital. Does anybody ever hear of it? No one here from Brooklyn. Anyway, it's a major hospital in New York, the Coney Island Hospital. Now, at the time my father took the shtela in the Coney Island Hospital, the city, the municipality of New York City, was not able to offer enough funds for a separate chapel for the Jewish patients. So there was one chapel for Catholic, and then you press the button and the bima revolved and you had the Protestant, and then you press the button and you had the Jewish Aron Kodesh. And the Shiloh was, because one of my father's major goals was to offer tefillah and services for the Jewish patients in the Kolon Hospital, are you allowed to daven in this area? Because this area, the same makom, the same location, was designated for a Catholic service. And by the way, Protestant is also the same issue, right? Catholicism and Protestantism, Christianity believes in the Trinity. The Trinity is Avodah Zarah. So you have now a makom Avodah Zarah. Is there any sort of way of allowing tefillah in a makom avodah zarah? This is a very major issue. And for the patients in Coney Island Hospital, this was very, very critical. My father urgently needed a heter. He knew that in this case, he would have to have connections with Rabbanim. Now, who would you say is the final posek in America? If you're going back to that time, you would say Rav Moshe Feinstein, right? So I just want to set the record straight. It's not Rav Moshe Feinstein. It was actually Rav Henkin. After Rav Henkin, Rav Moshe became the final word in America. So my father turns to Rav Henkin. First, before he turns to Rav Henkin, he's about to call up the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik. And in those days, there was a rabbi, if anybody ever heard of him, Izzy Klavan, and he used to field the questions and present them to the Rav. So my father describes to Izzy Klavan, that's how we know him in our family, the Shaila about the chapel in the Coney Island Hospital. So Rabbi Klavan says, without hesitation, do you need a heter for this? And of course, my father needed it desperately. Don't ask the Rav. There's not even a havamim that will allow you to have a service, because in the Rav's mind, we have to do everything to keep away from Christianity. So my father turns to Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin hears the Shiloh, and he's wavering back and forth. He realizes how critical this is, and he realizes also that Shilohs of this sort are going to come up over and over again. So he says to my father the following: I'm willing to permit it on one condition, that you have the agreement of another 4 Rabbonim, and he enumerates them by name. One of them was Rav Moshe Feinstein. The other was Rav Tamashov. If you ever heard, there were a whole bunch of Rabbanim who came from Europe in America. And this is early in the 20th century. And my father makes all these phone calls and sets up all these meetings to meet with all these Rabbanim. Now, very often, as you know, you'll see this also in a Hetamei Rabbanim. Hetamei Rabbanim requires the signature of 100 Rabbanim. Do all the Rabbanim that are signed on a Hetamei Rabbanim go through the sugya? Usually, they all rely on the first signature on top, because the one who signs first is the one he's the Rav who's behind the Heter Meir Rabbanim. So they all heard from my father that Rav Henkin was willing to be Matir, and they didn't want to cross swords with Rav Henkin. They all agreed, and my father goes back to Rav Henkin, tells them he got the Haskama. Rav Henkin says, go ahead and have services. The very next morning, before the first Shacharis in that chapel, my father gets a call from one of the head honchos in the New York City municipality, and he says, we just got an influx of funds and we are investing them in a separate chapel for the Jewish patients. So Lamaisa, my father never needed the heter. But when the word got around about the heter, this had a tremendous impact on the Navy, because in a ship, it's very difficult to have enough room on a ship in the Navy, you know, for Jewish patients. So they relied on this heter, Lamaisa, and they had a revolving bima, and all the soldiers, you know, in the Navy would daven in the same place, again, to three different religions. But again, what I try to illustrate to you is that you have to have a connection to Rabbanim for big, big shilas. But when did my father decide that the future of Klal Yisrael was at stake and he had to take an issue, and he made the decision on his own, and this time, Baruch Hashem, he had tremendous siyata nishma. How many people in this room have ever heard of an organization called the New York Board of Rabbis? Nobody. Oh, I see one hand going up. What denomination is represented on the New York Board of Rabbis? I'll give you four choices. Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, or all of the above. It's all of the above. Now here, there was a tremendous plugta amongst the Rabbanim in America, mostly between the European Rabbanim and the American Rabbanim. The European Rabbanim were dead opposed to joining membership with the New York Board of Rabbis. They held that if you join membership with this group, it's almost like tacitly you are approving of those denominations, because you're sitting together with them as equal, one vote per person. Every rabbi gets the same vote. Some of the American rabbis, and my father was at the forefront, held that we must join the New York Board of Rabbis. It's absolutely critical that the Orthodox rabbinate be represented in this body called the New York Board of Rabbis. And again, this, no one here in this room will ever have heard of WEVD, but anyway, WEVD was a radio station, which they used to say, the station that speaks your language, which meant that it was in Yiddish. And they called upon my father for an interview, and they had just interviewed one of the Rabbanim from the Agudas or Rabbanim of America, who had expressed an absolute opposition to the Rabbanim joining the New York Board of Rabbis. And then they interviewed my father a few days later, because they knew that my father was amongst the younger Rabbanim who was in favor of joining, of the Orthodox rabbinate joining the New York Board of Rabbis. So in the interview, when they asked my father, how can you as an Orthodox rabbi sit with conservative and reform rabbis, he answered the following. He said, look, the purpose and the mission of the New York Board of Rabbis is not to decide on halachic issues. The entire purpose is to represent the Jewish people and their interests against the goyim on issues like anti-Semitism, on other such issues. And therefore, it's absolutely critical that in this case, we have a united stand, klapei the goyim, and that all rabbis, Orthodox and the rest, should be together sitting and are participating in this board representing the Jewish people against the goyim, for the interests of the Jewish people. Now, my father influenced many other rabbanim to join the New York Board of Rabbis. And again, it came to the point where I would say that the New York Board of Rabbis had maybe about a third, or a little bit less than a third, of Orthodox rabbis represent. Now, where does Hashgacha prove that my father made the right decision? A major issue came up in the New York Board of Rabbis, and there was going to be a vote. The issue was intermarriage. Can we accept in the New York for membership the New York Board of Rabbis a rabbi that marries off a non-Jew and a Jew in a mixed ceremony? And the movement, the sort of like the spirit of the evening was to support accepting and validating, recognizing such a rabbi, even though he performs mixed marriages. My father gets up in front of the New York Board of Rabbis, again, representing not just the Orthodox, and he makes this passionate speech. My father was a great speaker, and he felt that the future of Klal Yisrael was at stake. And he said, how can we allow this to happen? We are undermining the future of the Jewish people. And somehow he influenced many of the other Rabbanim, some of whom were Reform at that time. Again, today the situation is totally different. I don't know if my father would have succeeded. But at the end, they won the vote. And the decision was made that any rabbi who performs a mixed marriage is not going to be accepted in this. And what this meant was a ripple effect throughout the United States. And in my father's mind, that justified the fact that Rabbanim have to be part of any organization of that sort that makes decisions, klapi the goyim. And he made that decision. So again, in the case of Bangor, Maine, when he tried to get rid of these shoftim, he failed miserably, he had to leave the city. But in the case of the New York Board of Rabbis, he took a strong stand. You know, I mentioned at the outset that sometimes a Rav is asked a question from like left field. You know, can I start Shiva here and end it on the cruise? I want to share with you a story. I got permission from my friend, Rabbi Judah Dardick, to tell you this story. Rabbi Dardick was a Rav, his first Rabbanus in Oakland, that's outside of San Francisco in California. He tells the following story. After he took the job as the Rav, two women who had attended his class, he had a class for beginners in Judaism. It was basically for people who knew nothing. These two women had never seen the inside of a synagogue, but they were very impressed with the class. And they decided, after listening to a whole series of lectures from Rabbi Judah, I don't know if anyone knows him, and they decided that if they should start perhaps going to a shul. And the only shul that they knew of was Rabbi Dardick's shul, which was an Orthodox shul. Now, in one of the lectures that he had given, he had mentioned that men and women sit in different parts of the shul during the service. So these two ladies come up to Rabbi Dardick and they ask him, in all seriousness, do we have to sit on two different sides of the mechitza? They had a certain kind of relationship. I don't know if you caught it. Did anybody catch what I said? Okay. This is for adults only, right? So Rabbi Dardick took this question very, very seriously. He gave them a whole lecture. And as a result, because he had taken it so seriously, they felt an even greater adoration and respect for him, and they became regular shul goers. So it's really interesting that when you come up with a shaila, like, you know, you and I think of a shaila, well, we're talking about Basa B'Cholov, we're talking about Melecha Shabbos, you know, we're dealing with Yehark Val Yavra. But Shiva, you know, on a cruise, off a cruise, you know, two women who have a relationship and they sit on two different sides. It's like, why take a shayla like that seriously? But the more serious you take a shayla, the more the people feel that you are relating to them and you're speaking to them. What is your name?
Ilan.
Ilan.
What did he answer them?
Oh, that you have to speak to him. I didn't get permission to reveal that.
Okay.
But I'll tell you this, he gave them a very serious, mature answer with all the sensitivity. And he told them where exactly they were allowed to sit, and they took it very, very well. And again, it only means, I'll give you another example. Erev Pesach, a Rav will get 1,000 shilas. When I say Erev Pesach, lav dafka Erev Pesach, but before Pesach. Some of the shilas are absolutely ridiculous. I mean, there's no chiyuv to, you know, to pay your house for Pesach. But if you blow off a question and you make fun of it, people lose respect. The connection is gone. So my humble advice is that any shaila that comes your way, even if it's laughable to you and it seems so insignificant, take it seriously. Give a person who asks a shaila a sense of encouragement. Wow, that's a fascinating shaila. Get back to you on it. Let me research it. You know, or give them a mature, sophisticated answer. It's a great way of building a relationship when you take a shaila. When you take a shaila seriously. I want to talk to you a little bit about the drasha. Now, what I'm going to tell you about the drasha is particularly appropriate for a sermon in the American rabbinate. But, as Rabbi Goldschneider said before, not all of you are going to end up in the American rabbinate. But I think some of these points are relevant to mechanchim, to leaders in general, how to prepare a drasha, what's the significance of a sermon, and I want to share with you a few things. Maybe I should have photocopied this article, but it's very, very long, and instead what I did was I made a note to myself which paragraphs I'd like to share with you. This is an introduction by my father to his book of sermons, and it's called Preparing a Jewish Sermon, Preparing a Drasha. And he makes a few points that I would like to emphasize because I think they bear recognition, even in a very modern context. Keep in mind, my father wrote this over 45 years ago. But he writes the following. Number one, Rabbanim are very, very involved in a host of duties, many of which are administrative, fundraising, executive duties, funerals, unveilings, weddings, meetings, visitations, and all sorts of trivia. They have little time to prepare Torah on their own. So my father writes the following, that Chazal have a phrase called Bikoveya Itim LeTorah. What it really means is steal time for Torah. This lesson is so critical when you're overwhelmed by so many different responsibilities, but you're not ready to transmit the Torah unless you're learning the Torah, if you don't have a constant connection to the Torah. So here, we're in an ideal situation. We're learning in Kol El here in Gruz, and we have no challenges. We don't have a million things on our plate. But when you become a Rav of a shul, there's so much to do. And sometimes the smaller the congregation, the more responsibilities that you have. So don't think it's a function of how large the shul is. And what's absolutely critical is to find time, to steal time from your daily schedule for learning Torah. Otherwise, it's very difficult. He writes the following. My practice is to jot down on index cards ideas or divrei Torah that I have or I like and file them under proper headings, either on the sedras or on the moadim. And when I read a sefer, I write on the inside cover of a sefer an index to those areas or those ideas that I thought were very important, that impressed me. And therefore, I don't have to go through the book to remind myself of what I want to get out of this book, because I've already made this table of contents. He goes on to say that everything in life could be a ripe area for drush. You can watch a play, you can read a book, you can go to a movie, you can watch television, anything that has some sort of moral, ethical message to it that could address religious problems can be used and can be integrated into a drasha. And he quotes Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, who said how important it is to sanctify the secular, l'kadesh ha'chomer, l'kadesh ha'chol. Kiddush ha'chol is when a rav sees a something on television, he says, wow, that's food for a drasha. So I remember in my youth, there used to be a very popular news, daily news, which was called 10 p.m. News. And it would always open with the same question. It is 10 p.m., do you know where your children are? That's how it opened. And of course, my father made all drasha this. Of course, anyone who said over the drasha either quoted my father or didn't quote my father, but that's irrelevant. So anything that you see, anything that you hear, and certainly Divrei Torah is really great material, and you should make a note of it and somehow put it down on an index card, and then you'll have access to it whenever you need it. Then he raises the following question. Should a person write out their drasha before the sermon? And he says it might be a good idea because you're able to polish up your diction and clarify your concepts. But he says you should never read a sermon, and this is true again for all mechanchim and all darshanim, never read it from a text. The key to success is eye contact. The key to success is people want to hear what you have to say. They want to hear you talking to them. Everyone in the audience should feel, wow, the rabbi is talking to me. And if you read a text, you may get the advantage of certain fancy, elaborate words, you know, that you studied for the SATs, but the people are not impressed by that. That doesn't touch them. And in preparing a sermon, the following adjectives, the following descriptions are critical. Number one, clarity. Number two, sincerity. Number three, drama and passion. You have to feel for what you're saying. Number four, humor. Number five, inspiration. Number six, contemporary. Number seven, eyes on the people. And most important is relevancy. What you're saying, what you're preaching, what you're transmitting has to be relevant to them. If you decide to give a drush on some philosophical topic that's very appropriate for a shir, it's not fitting for a drasha because it doesn't make an impact on the person's heart. It doesn't inspire them. They don't walk out with something. They may have some of the intellectuals in the audience may understand it on one level, but for most of the people, if they're not inspired, if it's not relevant to them, if it's purely philosophical, if it's about a religious theological issue, that's not success. What we need is relevancy. When I deliver my drasha, I seldom will follow the written text. I have only in front of me a short outline, and I don't even refer to the outline unless at some point I feel I must look at the little outline. What is the goal of a sermon? Number one, the rabbi must make an effort to interpret and revitalize old theological and ethical teachings. The glory of the Torah, of Rabbanus and teaching Torah, is to take something that was written thousands of years ago, a text of Chazal, and make it relevant, to show the people how we learn from Chazal, how it's alive. And I find in my Rabbanus that the most important text for Rabbanus is Pirkei Avos. If you can quote a Mishnah in Avos, most of the people will have some familiarity with Avos, and show how the ethics of Pirkei Avos is so relevant today and it's so inspiring, that gives the audience an extra love and adoration and respect for the Torah. Then he says, unless the darshan is absolutely convinced of the validity and the meaning, the significance of his message, if he's not totally given over to the fact that what he's transmitting is absolute truth, then his drasha will be a failure. People in the audience will sense that he doesn't really believe what he's saying. He's just going through the motions. He's waiting to finish his drasha and sit down because that's part of his salary. That's not going to be a successful drasha. He has a long discussion here, which is not for us, about how long a drasha should be. And the main thing he says is to keep the people excited about the drasha. Now, what kind of topics or themes should you choose for your drasha? He goes on to say that there are two major methods of giving over a drasha, and he gives them names. Let me see if I can follow this. If I can find this, just give me a second. Okay, maybe we'll find it as we go along. I just want to spend a few more minutes on this and go on to a few other topics about Rabbanus and literature. And he says the following, that it's very important for Rav to be connected to the issues of the day, especially issues that have a direct impact on the Jewish nation. And it's fair for Rav and right for Rav to comment on these issues. However, you have to be careful, and he warns you, if you're going to take an issue that might turn off people who have a different opinion, because these issues lend themselves to various opinions, then present your thesis in a way that allows others to disagree with you, and tell them that you're open to disagreement. Indicate that this is your opinion, it's a burning issue of the day, it could have an impact on the Jewish nation, and tell the people why that's so. He gives an example here, which I think is so relevant even today, you know, 45 years later. He says, if let's say you want to address the issue of Democrats, Republicans, or liberals, or the issue of pro-capital, you know, free capital, or labor, and so forth and so on, it's very nice to present what you think is the Jewish view, but be very sensitive about it. Make sure that although you are qualified as a Rav to distinguish between right and wrong, and you want to inform the people of what you think is your sense of what's right and what's wrong, be very careful in the way you present it. Don't be totally dogmatic about it. Allow for some discussion. The message of the Rav should concern itself with people and their problems. Sermons should deal with fears, anxieties, guilt, loneliness, doubts, family problems, failures, frustrations, grief. All of the above are sure to gain the interest and the attention of the audience. The most major fault of a drasha is irrelevancy. If a drasha doesn't address issues or feelings or challenges that the people experience, that's not a successful drasha. All right, here's where he presents two sort of structures of a drasha. He said there's one method which is called the expository method, and the other is the problem or project method. So let's go through the two. The project method starts with a problem. Here's the issue. And you suggest a solution to the issue, and then you go on to offer textual support for your solution to the problem. In the expository sermon, you start with the text, you ask a kasha on the text, you offer an explanation, and then you apply it to life. So whereas the first method is to start with the application to life, what is the issue, and then bring in a chazal or a pasuk and interpret it. The second way of doing it is, no, you start with a medrash, or you start with a problem in a pasuk, and then eventually you lead to its application to life. So my father goes on to say that in my experience, it really matters little whether one begins with the problem or one begins with the biblical or Talmudic or Midrashic text. It doesn't matter, and sometimes you can make a combination thereof. Both methods have their place, and they will both be advantageous if wisely used. It's all a question of mechanics. It's a technical issue of communication. But if the message is not relevant to life, if it doesn't teach a Jewish ideal, if it doesn't inspire people and address their needs and their challenges, then it fails its very essential purpose, which is to bring about an encounter between the divine elements of our tradition and the person who's sitting in the audience. The ultimate goal of the drasha is to address that issue, keep the people interested, and give them an inspiring sense of the beauty of the Torah, to connect them to Shechina, to connect them to the divine elements of Mesoras HaTorah. And finally, the last point he makes is that often it takes years and years for a rabbi to realize that the sermon he preaches is important. At first, Rabbanim tend to have a cynical attitude towards Drush. Many of us recall the time in our youth when we started as Rabbanim that we felt that the sermon is kind of a form of religious entertainment, that the congregation sits back, they sit in their comfortable pews with an unspoken challenge, as if to say to the rabbi, entertain me if you can. Unfortunately, there are such people who sit in every synagogue, but so what? The longer one remains in the rabbinate, the more he gets the feeling that it is a great and perhaps the most glorious calling in the world. Very emotional. The words of faith, of solace, of musar, mean a great deal to many, if not most of our people, much more than we expected and suspected at first. Time after time, people will come forward and say, Rebbe or Rabbi, I don't know whether you realize what your sermon meant to me at that particular time in my life. We should therefore be grateful to the Almighty for the privilege of giving our people an understanding of the timeless faith of Israel and for bringing them to an interpretation of life that is grounded and rooted in the soil of our Sinai. We should be happy that we were called upon by providence, by Hashgacha, to apply the wisdom of the past to the problems of the present and to help us assure the future of our people. We should be thankful for the opportunity to touch lives, shape their ideas, encourage their hearts, comfort their souls of those who come within the hearing of our voice. So those are just some of the main points in this 20-page introduction called How to Prepare a Drush. I want to go on to talk about the idea of fighting a battle. My father and many Rabbanim in that period of time had one major battle. Anybody guess what it was? Straight across America. The Mechitza. The mechitza issue, I hinted at it before when I spoke about Oakland, is the major issue. I mean, this almost did my father under because he took a strong stand on the mechitza issue. And basically, my father's approach was the following. In this case, where you're faced with so much opposition, there's no way of winning the battle if you go onto a head-on collision. But what you rather need is to develop a framework to cultivate friendship, to raise friends. People will support your position if they see how sincere you are, and they adore you, they love you, you're part of their close friendship circle. It's a different type of power of persuasion. It's not a persuasion which is intellectual. You can't just quote Shulchan Aruch. The people are not ready for that. And again, unless you get a rabbanus in a major community in America, if you're in a smaller community, and this is true even here in Eretz Yisrael, in many communities there's so much ignorance that to take on an issue like this one about where people will sit and how to set up a mechitza, unless you cultivate friendship, unless you build that strong foundation, unless you have succeeded in creating a framework and a following, you're not going to be able to succeed in those kinds of issues. Rav Moshe Feinstein, his tshuvas about mechitza went very far. And he was matir mechitzos that are very, very low, very small. And many relied on Rav Moshe. Rav Soloveitchik also found kulas with mechitzas which he wasn't happy with. And I think this tells us something about our role as leaders and answering shilas. I call it limited damage. What I mean is to say that sometimes the options are both pretty bad, but try to get the best of all evils. There's a famous tshuva of Rav Avadia Yosef about a girls' school in which the girls were coming to school wearing miniskirts. And the heads of the school wanted to allow women to wear pants, to wear slacks. Rav Avadia Yosef was absolutely opposed to women wearing slacks. But in this case, he actually was martyred. He felt that this was the best of all evils. It was a lot better than a miniskirt. So what it means is that in halachic framework, sometimes we have no choice. We can't give up the entire enterprise of running a shul and having a community and inspiring people and being makariv people. So what we have to do sometimes is find the most limited violation of the law. You know, there's an organization here in Israel called Tzohar Rabbanim. And what they're famous for, amongst other things, is that when they officiate at a wedding where the people are not frum, what they'll do is, the Rav will recite all Sheva Brachos himself. He won't even allow them to call up people for the Sheva Brachos. He'll present it as if that's the requirement of the ritual ceremony of Seder Kiddusha. The Rav Zichron Levracha is famous for standing under the chuppah and asking for a bich, you know, a zmiris bech, you know, book where he could read the Sheva Brachos. So later on, one of the Talmidim said to Rebbe, you know the Brachos by heart. Why did you stop the ceremony to get that? He says, because the kala was not dressed properly. I couldn't make the Brachos. So the best of all evils was that I would look at the sitter and I wouldn't have to look at the kala. So this is something that's very critical. And here I want to get to the next topic, and that's Jewish education, the focus on youth. There's no question that here in Israel, and how much more so in Chutz Laaretz, the focus of a rabbi has to be on the youth. The youth is going to be the future of the transmission of Klal Yisrael. Ki heshiv levavos al bonim. And to transmit the Torah to the youth is fraught with so many challenges. I remember my wife and I were sent to the Soviet Union of then by the Misrad HaChutz to teach Torah to the refuseniks. And again, it was a very delicate operation. I'm not going to go into details. We could talk about that. Or you talked to Rabbi Rakefet. He was very active in this whole program. And what we found was that the greatest challenge was getting the youth involved, because keep in mind that the Jewish nation under the Soviets for 70 years had been denied Jewish education. It was very difficult, even in Lubavitch circles where they had chadarim that were underground. Even there, it was extremely dangerous, very challenging to transmit any sort of religion under the Soviets. But the future is in the children. So you take a position of leadership, and you have to reach out to the children. Now, when you're reaching out to the children, you're really interested in the weakest of the children, because you want to give them Yiddishkeit. But here's the challenge. I call it the dialectic of Jewish education. You have some students that are excellent, that have background, and they can learn at a rapid pace, and you slow them down by introducing into the classroom children who are so weak, they don't know an aleph from a beis. And it's a very, very difficult situation. The only recommendation that I can have is that you try to give special lessons. Maybe even take it upon yourself as the Rav, if you can fit it into your busy schedule, to learn privately in a tutorial way with those children who are more advanced. Now, here is a very important halachic issue that goes way beyond halacha. It touches on the very fabric of the Jewish nation and its future. The sugya, in a number of places, especially in Masechta Brachos, concludes that we're not allowed to teach Torah to, quote, a Talmud she'eino hogman. The Gemara tells us in Brachos Adaf Chav Ches that this was the major issue between Rabbi Gamliel, who is the Nasi, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Gamliel would not let anyone into the Beis Medrash unless he was Tocho Kibara. And at the end, they deposed Rabbi Gamliel, they replaced him with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Ayin Shom. It's a very profound sugya. And on that very day that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah became the Nasi be Israel, the Gemara talks about 400, hundreds, probably thousands of students entered into the Beis Medrash. Bala halacha, the Rambam paskins in Hilchos Talmud Torah Perek Dalet, that we don't teach Torah to a Talmud Sheino Hogman. So who's a Talmud Sheino Hogman? Many of the Mefarshim say it's someone who's not ethical. Others say that a Talmud Sheino Hogman is not interested in a genuine way in the Torah. He really wants to undermine the Torah. He has an animosity for the Torah. I would suggest today, we spoke about it last year here in the same room, about the concept of Tinok Shenishpa, that our children today, who have little background, are not lahachisniks. They're not coming from a negative attitude to try to undermine the Torah. They don't know. They may not be eager to learn. You have to inspire them to love Torah. So a Talmud Sheino Hogman, according to that Shita, is irrelevant today. And therefore, I think we have to have a much more liberal policy about who we can accept. Unfortunately, as Torah knowledge, on the one end, you know, gets more and more intense on a higher, higher level, but at the same time, paradoxically, you know, the lower echelons who are weak and have not been exposed to Yiddishkeit are sinking below the line of survival. So we have two extremes. So we've created educational institutions that cater only to the best of the best. And we refuse to open our doors for those who might be possibly defined, according to some shitas, as a Talmud Sheino Hogman. And this kind of exclusivity is great, perhaps, for one or two schools, but once you universalize that principle and education becomes for the few and the many and the advanced, Klal Yisrael is in bad shape. So we have to find a way to overcome this problem. That's what I call the dialectic. You know, there's a thesis, there's an antithesis. I don't know what the final resolution is, but every leader in Klal Yisrael has to face this issue and has to deal with it, because Jewish education is the key to the transmission of Torah to the next generation. Let me mention to you another few issues that Rabbanim are going to have to face. Number one, getting others involved. What I call chalukat tafkidim, divvying up responsibilities, especially in the administrative area. You've got to get others willing to share the burden with you. And it's a challenge. It's not easy. You have to win over friends and ask them to take an active part in running the shul. When it comes to education, when it comes to the actual teaching of Torah, Here we have to move with great caution, and we have to decide how to choose. Once you choose someone, and you allow him to give the drasha for you, or him to say the Dvar Torah Shal Shudas, then you get problems, because next week someone else wants to speak, and he's not right. So just like we said in education, we have this dialectic, because if we introduce into the classroom children who might upset the learning, because A, they don't know anything, and B, they want to play around, they're not serious, and that could have an impact and an influence on the good students and bring them down instead of bringing the bad students up, so too when it comes to divvying up these responsibilities, as soon as you appoint someone to transmit the Torah, you open up a Pandora's box, and you know, it's like opening up a can of worms. You never know where it's going to lead to. So this requires a great deal of sensitivity. You want to get everyone involved. You want everyone to feel that he's part of the process. In teaching Torah, giving shiurim, you always want to get people to express their opinion. Every question, as we said at the outset, should be taken seriously. And now I get to the question of all questions for a Rav, and that is fundraising. I don't know what to call fundraising. For some people, it's absolutely a nightmare. You know, they say it's fundraising is like a dirty word almost, you know. But in many shuls, if the Rav doesn't get involved in fundraising, it's very problematic, to say the least. Now I want to make an opening statement about fundraising. I believe, and I got this also from a Masorah from my father, that a Rav has to feel an absolute hakaras hatov to the institution which taught him Torah. That's upgrade. That goes without saying. So for example, my father was a Talmud of Reb Yiskel Chanan Yeshiva, and during the period in which, I don't know if you know the name, Dr. Belkin was president, so every year my father would have a fundraiser for Yeshiva University. Dr. Belkin, very often, if he could make it, he would come and speak, and the shul raised significant funds for Yeshiva University. That, I think, goes without saying. So if you learned in Chofetz Chaim Yeshiva, then you have a loyalty to your yeshiva. That's where you got your training. The Smicha program, by the way, in Chofetz Chaim, I think is a 10-year program. So you have a lot of Hakaras HaTov. In Yeshiva University, in my day, it was a 3-year program. Now I understand it's a 4-year program. But there's Hakaras HaTov. Then number two is Eretz Yisrael. So if you're in Chutz Laretz and you could raise funds for Israel, and that could express itself in so many different ways. One of the most popular ways of raising money, and it touches the souls and the feelings of Jews throughout America, is to raise money for the IDF, especially for lone soldiers who volunteer to come to Israel, put their lives on the line for the sake of the state. So these are the areas in which you can easily evoke a feeling of empathy and charity and chesed. There are other areas that also require fundraising, and that's the shul itself, of course. And here you have to define the needs of the shul in such a way, if you come and you present to the membership of the shul some sort of general campaign or a capital fund campaign for the building of the shul, it might not touch their hearts. You know, they'd rather sit in, what do you call them, old chairs than give out of their pockets for new chairs, new furniture, and to renovate the building. But if you can focus on specific projects, and projects that will get the community together, the fundraising now becomes a means to an end. It becomes a method, not just for the mitzvah of tzedakah, for Torah as well. So, for example, as we mentioned before, the focus of the Rav, primary responsibility is the youth. If you can create a fundraising project for the youth, let's say certain trips that they will have, you know, certain seminars, they'll go to NCSY for Shabbaton, and we need some funds because the parents are not able to pay for it. If it's Jewish education and sending them to yeshivas, etc., etc., you create these fundraising campaigns and you get the people inspired. And you're makayim so many different mitzvahs. So of course you're embarrassed. Who likes to ask someone to take out their checkbook? But if you realize that the cause is great and that your responsibility as the leader of the community is to raise these funds, you can do it. But the drawback to it, it can do you under. It just can be so time consuming. Forget about what we said at the outside. Steal time to be koveh itim l'Torah. Now you've taken upon yourself a fundraising responsibility. It's almost impossible to juggle it all. And all Ravon are underpaid because people don't realize, they don't appreciate how much a Rav puts in so many different ways. Last few points. Number one, the emphasis on teaching Torah to women. Again, this goes without saying in a yeshiva diversity context, but when you're out there in the field, in a small community, as a Rav, as a leader, and especially here in Israel, the emphasis on Torah for women has to be a prime concern. My father used to always say that Eishes Chayil Miyimsa, that the most important element in the transition of Torah is teaching the women. Because ultimately the woman, when she gets married and raises a family, she determines the religious nature of the family, much more than he does. He's out there working long hours at the business, and she's the one who really has the direct contact, raising the children and impacting them, inspiring them in Yiddishkeit. We must inspire the women. And personally, in my Rabbonis, the older I get, the more I realize how much the women appreciate Torah. It's just unbelievable. On different levels, not all of the women are intellectual because they haven't gotten that background in the yeshiva environment, and certainly in a kiruv situation of balas tshuva. But once they get on to religion, once they get on to Yiddishkeit, it's mind-boggling how far they can go. And they so much appreciate when you reach out to them and teach Torah to them. Another few very small points, just from experience, and this, I'm not telling you a personal story, but a story of a friend of mine. Be very careful with emails. Basically, sending an email, even to a member of the shul that you consider a friend, is like putting it up on, what is it today, Facebook. You know, it's public accessible knowledge. And I know a friend of mine who lost his position at Rabbanus because he supported a certain member for the presidency in the election for president of the shul. He sent an email to one of the members of the shul, and I'm not going to go into detail about what he wrote in that email, but as a result, he had to leave the Rabbanus. So be careful with the internet. The internet today is like saying something in public. Another issue, which again you have to be very careful about, is confidentiality. The purpose of a Rav, the most glorious goal of a Rav, is to listen to people. Not like the cynical story about someone who said to the psychiatrist, after so many years of working as a psychiatrist, you have so many people who lay down on the couch and they pour out their holes, their hearts and their souls, and you're listening. You must get depressed from it. So the psychologist says, who's listening? But in the case of a Rav, we are listening, and that's what people want. Even if you don't have the answer to them, the answers to their problems, they want you to listen. And even if you don't have a PhD in psychology, that's what a Rav is for. A Rav, whether he's professionally trained as a psychologist or not, plays the role of a psychologist in the best of scenarios, because it means that they trust you and they're very open with you. And by sharing and unburdening themselves, you are able to create a very, very profound impact on their lives, a very profound friendship relationship, but confidentiality is very important. Again, I know of a Rav who heard something during a session, a private meeting, he publicized it, and he had to leave his Rabbanus. My last pitch for you is what I call the smile. Always smile. Even if you're not happy with your position in Rabbanus, make it as if you're happy with your opponents. Because if you're going to walk around with a sour face, they're going to know that this is not the position that you want to stay in. So even if it means putting on a little bit of a facade, it's very important in public. Always make yourself happy. You know, transmit the message that you're privileged to be their Rav. And a smile is perhaps the most contagious disease that we have. If you smile, people will smile with you. And there's nothing more inspiring than a good joke, than some humor that will put them into the right mood, and it really connects people with the Rav. Very often, a parishioner will forget all that he heard in the sermon, but he'll remember the humor, he'll remember the story, he'll remember the smile. And that's my pitch to you all. Yiratzon mein, be his will that we could all serve as agents of the Ribono shel Olam. We're here in this world. We want to make our contribution. We want to impact on the souls of Klal Yisrael. We want to uplift Klal Yisrael because we're facing very difficult times. You should all be Zochim Yirtz Hashem to do that, to fill those important roles. And even if you don't go into the Rabbanis, wherever you'll be, even if you'll be a Balabas in a community, people will look up to you because of your Torah knowledge. You represent Klal Yisrael. The opportunities for Kiddush Hashem are immense. I don't want to mention the flip side of Kiddush Hashem. It's a little bit dangerous and tricky, but I'm sure that you'll all do great work. I want to take this opportunity to thank everyone for coming and for giving me your attention. Thank you, Rabbi Goldschneider, for inviting me, and you should all be matzliach. L'man Klal Yisrael to be a Kiddush Hashem, Keni Ratzon. Amen. Thank you very much. Any questions, comments? I don't know what time you have to leave, but I'm here. Okay.
All right, if you can just pass.